Welcome to Leftist Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Kelly Campbell and Regna Merritt with Portland Physicians for Social Responsibility recently received the Visionary Leaders Award from the National Physicians for Social Responsibility Organization. This award recognizes individuals and organizations for their exemplary efforts to advance nuclear weapons abolition and addressing environmental risks to human health, including the catastrophic consequences caused by climate change. Kelly has served as the executive director of Oregon PSR chapter for the past 10 years. Regna recently retired after 7 years as the Healthy Climate Program Director for the organization and now serves on its advisory board. The awards committee appreciated their efforts to incorporate environmental justice and equity as a model for the entire PSR network. Today we talk with Kelly and Regna, along with Damon Mott-Story, who is now filling Regna's old position at PSR, about the issues on which they worked so passionately that won them this award. Regna's many successes in leading coalitions that have defeated numerous fossil fuel projects in the Northwest, and Kelly's work to build a modern nuclear disarmament movement. Regna, Kelly, and Damon, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So first, let's talk a bit about this award, and why were you so thrilled that you got it?
Well, let me say first that it was a huge gift just to be able to work with the people I love, doing the work I love at Oregon PSR. What a great team, and the coalitions that we engaged with were amazing. So I accepted my award on behalf of the Healthy Climate Action Team, a group of Oregon PSR members who work very hard every week to stop bad fossil fuel projects and to advance clean energy policies and just policies. So that's first off, a big thank you to the people that we've worked with over the years on Healthy Climate and those who continue to work in coalitions that connect us.
Well, actually, I find it very interesting that PSR has become really part of the forefront of fighting against all the fossil fuel infrastructure in the region. Because when I first was involved with PSR back in the early 80s, the total focus was nuclear disarmament. And in fact, Helen Caldicott at that point didn't even want to look at nuclear power because she thought it was just a minor problem compared to like blowing the earth up with nuclear weapons. And I found it very interesting when I started getting involved with the fossil fuel fight to see how engaged PSR was with that. And I'm wondering, Regna, by the time you came into PSR, was it the fossil fuel focus already a big part of the organization?
It became a big part starting in 2012. We were obviously aware of the threat, the catastrophic threats that it posed, but we were approached by the Sierra Club in 2012 and offered some funding to bring the health voice to the climate campaign, and we jumped on that opportunity. At that point, we started to work on coal exclusively, and just to say something about the coal efforts, that work began with the Power Pass Coal Coalition, and we were fighting six coal export proposals in the Pacific Northwest at that time, including one in British Columbia, and that coalition connected ranchers in Wyoming and Montana with community activists stretching along the rail lines and the great rivers of Montana and Idaho and Washington and Oregon and all the way to the Pacific Coast. And we connected doctors and nurses and epidemiologists with community activists, commercial fishermen, the faith community, and Native American tribes. And as you know, the tribes rely on salmon for food as well as for their cultural and spiritual sustenance. And we saw salmon populations threatened in each of these proposals. So the Native American tribes have been incredibly powerful partners in these coalition efforts. So that, you know, we saw amazing success in that coalition, although we're still fighting in the courts on the Longview Millennium proposal.
Right.
And a big shout out to Earth Justice for their continued efforts to support the very sound decisions of the Washington Department of Ecology. I also want to give a shout out to Maya Bellin, the director of the Department of Ecology, who worked so hard to protect public health and the environment in her tenure as director there. And she's stepping down this month. So we owe her and the Department of Ecology a great debt of gratitude for the stellar work that they've done to protect us.
Well, actually, I think about the coal fight, and it almost feels like it's in the past. As you mentioned, all six proposals have been killed. Millennium is, I think if Trump weren't president, actually Millennium would be dead now too. But it's basically limping along in these pathetic lawsuits, but it has no permits or anything. What's astonishing, though, to me, when I was so been so engaged in the fact gas fight and still, unfortunately, the oil train fights, the tar sands oil that's coming through Portland now. But I was coming back from an action actually in Kalama a few months ago and saw a coal train coming across the bridge in Vancouver and I guess heading up to what's still the last remaining coal-fired plant in Washington up in Centralia, which is going to close very soon. And it gave me this kind of shudder because I realized you think you've finished these battles, but those coal trains are still rolling.
They are, and in fact, some of them are going to British Columbia. We succeeded in stopping the development of a new export terminal in BC, but there is still coal going to West Shore Terminal in BC. So it's not over yet. The other, as you pointed out, the Trump administration has a war on...
War on us
in the Pacific Northwest and the Thin Green Line, the coalitions that have connected us. And, state-led conversations like Wyoming. There's a lot of pressure on the governor to file its own lawsuit against the state of Washington. The huge national issue about the attack on the Clean Water Act and the ability of states to protect their environment and the public health. So that will be forever a threat as long as this administration is controlling politics nationwide.
I'm just going to throw out, if you would like to see Trump impeached, there's going to be a rally tomorrow at 5:30 in Waterfront Park, right just south of... just south of the Burnside Bridge.
At what time?
It starts at 5:30, and it's part of Move On has a national network of impeachment rallies tomorrow on the eve of what's going to most likely be the great impeachment vote on Wednesday. And then, of course, to figure out how to move things into the Senate in a meaningful way is the next struggle. But I think it's going to be an exciting next 2 months as we, and I'm really hoping that with some grassroots creativity, we might actually have some better successes than people are predicting right now. Well, Kelly, I want to move on to your award. And I understand that you are basically being acknowledged for a lot of the work you've done in helping to build a new nuclear disarmament movement. Now, this is maybe something that people think is even more dead than coal, nuclear power. Who's thinking about nuclear power? But I learned from Damon last week that, in fact, there's a new resurgence of nuclear power here in Oregon on the research level. So let's talk a bit about what your work has been and what your work's going to be in the next few months.
Right. So the main focus of this work is actually still around nuclear weapons and nuclear power because they're inextricably linked. And they really are, as you mentioned, PSR's founding issues was physicians, nurses, and other health professionals realizing you can't cure a nuclear war. You have to prevent it from happening. And that's really how PSR got its start in the 60s and then was revived by Helen Caldicott in the late 70s and early 80s and our chapter that was started here in 1981 for those reasons. And as you mentioned, unfortunately, none of that has really changed. In fact, we're actually at a more dangerous predicament than we have been since the Cold War. And so PSR is really leading the way around the country and here in Oregon in terms of talking about nuclear weapons. What we've been doing here is really examining nuclear weapons as a social justice issue, right? That the people most impacted by nuclear weapons are people of color, are women. In fact, we have a fact sheet out around the disproportionate effects of nuclear weapons. And one of the things it looks at is, that women actually are more impacted by nuclear radiation than men. And the scientists don't actually even have all the answers, because why would you research it? It's women.
I'm curious, why are women more impacted? Does it have to do with our physiology, or does it have to do more with social things?
That's the speculation, but there actually isn't enough research to answer that question accurately. Things like that are still outstanding that we just don't even know. So the work that we've been doing here is really looking at nuclear weapons from a different angle than maybe was done in the 80s, or, you know, reviving it for a new generation and looking at the fact that we're spending all this money on the military and on nuclear weapons, whereas, you know, we need money for housing and education and healthcare and all these things that would provide true security. We've been working with the growing Marshallese population in Oregon. Oregon's one of the top states for folks from the Marshall Islands coming to the United States. And as many people probably know, the Marshall Islands is where the U.S. has tested nuclear weapons. They're now also at the forefront of climate change. And there's some really incredible Marshallese activists from youth all the way to elders here in our state and in the Pacific Northwest that are getting engaged on a lot of these issues. And so helping to raise up their voices around it. We passed a couple policies that are pretty exciting. Legislative session, we passed what was called Senate Joint Memorial 5 that supported the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. So there's a UN treaty that was passed in 2017 that would prohibit nuclear weapons in the same way that we've prohibited landmines and chemical weapons. It would basically say that these weapons are illegal. And that has the support of 122 countries around the world. You can probably name the countries who don't support it. Guess what? The U.S. is one of them, leading
Russia,
the way.
China.
Exactly. The nuclear weapon states and those that are
How about France? They're a nuclear weapon state.
Yeah, they don't support it either. But this came out of the General Assembly. It came out, it was kind of a new way for the UN to approach nuclear weapons, to say, we're not going to go through the Security Council. We're going to have the people of the world have a say, because if nuclear weapons are used anywhere, people around the world are going to suffer. A PSR report that came out a few years ago talks about that even a small-scale nuclear war would mean 2 billion people starve around the planet. So this is, you know, it's not as climate change, right? It's not a local issue. It's a local issue and a global issue. And so we have to tackle it here. So anyway, we passed a state resolution that's really the strongest and most justice-focused resolution of the states that have passed something like this, supporting the nuclear ban treaty. And then we just passed one in Portland a couple weeks ago, mirroring the same thing.
Well, I find it interesting that there's this connection between the impacts of nuclear war and the impacts of climate chaos, and particularly in the Pacific Marshall Islands and the other islands in the South Pacific that were nuclear weapons testing zones. And I'm not sure what's going on there now, but they've certainly been impacted in the past. And I was thinking about how Rachel Carson saw the connection between nuclear fallout and pesticide fallout back in the 1960s and 50s. And so there seems to be this overarching connection. I want to throw this out to you, Damon, now that you are filling Regna's shoes at PSR. How do you do this kind of cross-sectionality of these interlocking issues?
That's a really great question, yeah. And really, I think you can see that reflected in the way that Oregon PSR has changed its programmatic structure over the years, because we used to have sort of different silos for looking at, you know, climate and energy issues. And then specifically, we, you know, had a different program that worked on nuclear power issues, a different program that worked on environmental health. And we've now kind of consolidated those three areas into looking at sort of a really broad and intersectional look at sort of climate and energy issues as being all sort of really interrelated and connected. And I think one of the ways that you can kind of then also draw the connections between, you know, the nuclear power industry and the nuclear weapons industry is that they're both drawing upon the same destructive process of uranium mining and refining, and then the actual process of either generating nuclear power or creating, you know, nuclear weapons, then creates this enormous amount of waste that we still don't have a solution for, right? And so this is one of the problems at the Marshall Islands, is that the waste from the nuclear weapons testing is still there. And they put a concrete dome over some of it in the Eniwetok Atoll. And that Runeet Dome is actually being threatened by sea level rise, to the point that some of that contaminated material is now starting to get back into the water and washing into the shores of where people live. And so I think those are some of the ways in which we're able to kind of point to some case studies and examples of how these issues are all really interrelated and linked and are impacting people's health and lives today, even if nuclear weapons are not being used.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. Today we're talking with David Mott Story, Kelly Campbell, and Reg Namara, who are with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. And this conversation is triggered by an award that Regna and Kelly recently won from the National PSR Office. But we're talking about all the interconnecting issues that PSR works on and looking at the connections between fighting climate change through fighting fossil fuel and also dealing with the resurgence of nuclear issues. So, Regna, I want to get back to kind of, I want to do a brief history of all your successes with fighting fossil fuel. We sort of done coal. And I mean, with coal now, is the big concern really just fighting Millennium until they finally give up?
Well, and fighting the administration's efforts to gut the Clean Water Act, as I previously stated. The administration would like to rip the rights of states away to protect the environment and public health. And so that's an ongoing effort. But I want to do a great, I'm doing a bow to two other coalitions that we've been involved with. Four, actually, now that I think of it. There are so many. But the Power Past, the Stand Up to Oil campaign continues. And
actually is intensifying now.
It has intensified. Mm-hmm. And your listeners are well aware of what's been going on with Zenith and the pressure that has been put on the city to protect, to enforce its existing protections and move them forward. And then with global partners on the Columbia.
Which is out near Clatskanie, right?
Yes. And So that work continues, as does work to monitor the expansion of refineries in Anacortes and elsewhere. So that
what this, about U.S. This, soil this, in Tacoma?
Oh yes. And so, you know, and then there's the Power Past Frack Gas Coalition, which has been in the news recently because of the sit-in and the huge rally at the state capitol and then the sit-in that led to the arrest of 21.
And we'll talk about
that
a little more.
The governor's office. Yeah. So, I mean, there have been so many victories. You know, the obvious one, the obvious big one locally was for Stand Up to Oil was the Tesoro. And again, I want to bring in...
Explain what that was people who don't...
The oil that would have been the largest oil by rail export terminal in the country. And by pulling individuals and organizations together, we were able to stop that.
And it was going to be where?
It was going to be in Vancouver, right across the river. And there were as all of the issues with rail, there are environmental justice concerns. But there were local concerns regarding a low-income community located, the Fruit Valley neighborhood located near that terminal. And then there was a prison that probably would have like been blown up had there been an accident at that proposed terminal. So I want to give a big shout out to people like Dr. Patsy Kohlberg and Ann Turner and Theodora Tsongas who really
well, I see
help.
Every single hearing I go to, actually.
Well, they help zero in on the environmental justice aspects of these terminals, whether it was the coal terminal in the proposed coal terminal in Longview or the proposed oil terminal in Vancouver or the proposed frack gas terminal in Coos Bay. So they've done the deep dive into the demographics and taken a close look at the health outcomes for the communities that are closest to the proposed terminals and, in the case of Jordan Cove, the pipeline, and the impacts of the tribe. So, you know, bringing back this frame of who suffers worst and who suffers most, and it's frontline communities, communities of color, et cetera. So, and to that, you know, I want to speak a little bit to PSEF, which was
Portland Clean Energy Fund,
which was a very important part of our work near the end of my time as a Healthy Climate Program Director. And, I do consider that to be a stunning and beautiful example of a local Green New Deal that can be replicated. And big shout out to everybody who worked on that. It was a big, beautiful team. And this is the movement building that we're talking about rather than the victories from one discrete terminal after another, although they're very important. Just as important is building that movement of connected individuals and organizations who can participate in elections, elect good port commissioners, for example, pass a beautiful policy for to provide low-income communities and frontline communities with green energy as the Portland community.
And also transitional jobs.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. I mean, Damon could talk about the Portland Clean Energy Fund and its current status, but that was, like, I think one of the reasons that Kelly and I received that award was that there was a lot of focus, national focus, on Portland and innovative ways that we've moved the needle.
I will actually say something about the Clean Energy Fund. It was one of the big people behind it was now City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty.
Yes.
And I'm not sure how much that campaign helped propel her to public office, but I guess she probably would have done it without it.
She was well qualified without the campaign.
But I think it was one of the places where people who don't listen to KABU, because Joanne is on, I think, now every other Thursday, but she's been on every Thursday morning during the talk radio hour. And people in many different communities, but particularly the African-American community, knew her. But I think there were certainly probably certain white environmentalists who had no idea who she was if they didn't listen to KABU. And that she, through that, she was part of one of the forces that brought together this really amazing coalition. And Damon, why don't you talk more about that?
Sure, yeah. So we now have, you know, thanks to the early efforts of, you know, not just Joanne Hardesty, she played a huge role, but also folks from the Native American Youth and Family Center and the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon and Verde, the Coalition of Communities of Color. Those were really some of the core groups that, started years and years ago, just talking about the very early concepts of this sort of thing. And it actually, you know, it was a lot of time spent, you know, almost a full year spent, you know, policymaking and coalition building before a ballot measure was even filed, right? So it's like this long-term movement building that led to an incredible campaign that reached out to different parts of the city that often are not reached out to for electoral politics issues. And I find this quite phenomenal. Not only did we win by 65% of the vote, but we also got more voter turnout on our issue than on a ballot measure that was higher up on the ballot, which really just shows the incredible enthusiasm and energy that people have behind these Green New Deal-like policies of understanding that we really need to make a just transition now. You know, one of the phrases that I've heard in the coalition is that a transition to renewable energy is likely inevitable, and especially in a place like Portland where we're, you know, city leaders really see the importance of getting off of fossil fuels. We've committed to 100% renewables. So a transition to renewables is inevitable, but a just transition is not. And so that's what really strikes me as innovative and powerful about Portland Clean Energy Fund is that, you know, that's bringing $44 to $61 million of funding every single year in perpetuity to make sure that we can build the renewable energy future we need in the communities that need it most, and to make sure that job opportunities are present for everyone.
Now, I know that there was a hearing at City Council last Thursday. I was unfortunately out of town, so I didn't go, and I haven't heard what happened, but there was some concern that City Council was going to amend the clean energy bill so that it was going to create loopholes so that there were three big business areas that weren't going to be taxed. So what happened with that?
Yes, so they did, in fact, vote to do that, and that's kind of it's a bit of a mixed bag sort of a situation, right? So,
Some of them made sense, but there was one that really made no sense at all to me. So what were the three areas?
The three exemptions that passed were one was for construction companies, one was for garbage haulers, and one was the fees that were charged on retirement plans. Not the money in retirement plans, but the fees on retirement plans. For construction, you know, there's an argument to be made around, you know, this is something that's looking to fuel in new innovation and diversification of the construction workforces. And so that's kind of aligned with the values of the measure. With garbage hauling, it's kind of interesting because the measure exempts utilities, but Portland City Code doesn't consider garbage hauling to be a utility.
It actually should be.
Right. So that one was, you know, that kind of makes some sense. I think the insurance plan one was made a little less sense, but
so that's a benefit for the insurance companies,
right? So
there's a new target in terms of the fossil fuel fight is to go after the banks and the insurance mm-hmm. companies that are financing fossil fuel.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I just wonder how to if that's the case, why would insurance companies get an exemption from
Right. So we didn't really see as much of a reason for that particular exemption. And, you know, I think one thing is that it really deserves to be made clear is that all along in the ballot measure campaign, the language in the measure has been that, you know, the surcharge applies to any retailer that nets over $1 billion in national sales and over $500,000 a year in Portland. And that includes retail sales and the sales of services, including but not limited to things like banking services. And so this really wasn't a big, like, you know, switcheroo or, you know, anything like that. It was this was something that was sort of a part of the measure all along.
So what does it mean in terms of how well the this bill is still going to be financed?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I understand this is going to be a big cut in revenue as a result.
The previous revenue projections were from $54 to $71 million, and now we're looking at between $44 and $61 million. Now, in the campaign, we were using very conservative revenue estimates of $30 million. So, you know, we're still looking at more than what we were in campaign season looking at, and still a lot more than we had previous to passing this measure when we had no dollars in, for these kinds of projects. And so... I think the really important thing is going to be for Portlanders to watch and hold city councilors accountable on not letting any future exemptions come through, because we all know that big business loves to take a look at these sorts of things and weasel their way out of paying their fair share in any way that they can.
Well, there was a lot of opposition. In fact, I remember standing on 82nd Street about a week before the election last year, waving signs in front of Walmart. So why was I there? What was I doing?
You know, and there was a lot of big corporate opposition, but really no popular opposition to speak of, right? You know, there were, you know, massive, you know, multi-tens of thousand-dollar checks being cut by Walmart and Amazon and a bunch of these other really big companies, right? But, like, the people were really united on this sort of thing. In fact, there were these two immigrant business owners who were tricked into being put on the opposition campaign's website. And when they actually realized that their images were being used for the opposition campaign, they, you know, wanted that to cease because they said, oh, no, we actually support this measure. You know, which really goes to show what incredible grassroots support there was for it. So I think, you know, the truth is that, you know, Portlanders support the Portland Clean Energy Fund, but the big businesses that are used to not having to pay their fair share for anything wanted it to stop.
There was one concern, though. I think there was a bill passed in the state legislature this past session, that basically will not allow any other communities around the state to pass anything like that. Is that true?
Right. So the funding mechanism for the Portland Clean Energy Fund is a surcharge on gross receipts, specifically on the municipal level. And yes, then the Oregon State Legislature passed a bill that included a provision that stops anything less than anything lower than the state government from being able to pass those kinds of gross receipts funding mechanisms. So I personally would really like to see that overturned, because not just even for, you know, clean energy projects, but this is an important local funding tool for all kinds of good services and policies.
So where does our governor stand on this?
You'd have to ask her. I don't know.
maybe someday she'll come on the show. I don't know. In the meantime, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Damon Watt-Story, who's with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, along with the executive director, Kelly Campbell, and recently retired and still advisory board member, Regna Mera. And we're talking about the amazing work that this organization's been doing all along to... basically inject the public health component into a lot of environmental fights. You about to say something, Damon?
Yeah, I would just say before we wrap up the Portland Clean Energy Fund conversation, I just want to share the really cool news that I just got back from a convening in Miami, Florida, of six different cities that are committed to 100% renewable energy. Chicago, Atlanta, Pueblo, Colorado, a bunch of different cities that are working on this. And sort of the universal feedback I was getting from other leaders doing this work in other parts of the country is that they are so amazed by the Portland Clean Energy Fund, and they're looking to it as this real innovative model for how we can achieve a Green New Deal, even when our federal and state governments are failing to act to address the climate crisis. And so that was pretty cool. And then to have that conference in Miami, where they're really on the front lines of the issue, was
underwater in the issue, actually, beyond the front lines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'll reiterate that one of the big lessons here is not just that we can do a new Green Deal, but that Portland environmental leadership learned how to follow the lead of frontline communities mm-hmm. of color and representatives of people of color. So to me, that was perhaps another reason why we received the national recognition from Physicians for Social Responsibility. And for a last little bit on that award, it was such an honor to be sitting with Helen Caldicott, who received a Lifetime Achievement Award, and one of the co-founders of the Sunrise Movement. So when, you know, these dark days, when it seems very bleak, I just get such a shot of excitement and enthusiasm and inspiration from the Sunrise Movement and from our partners in the Portland Clean Energy Fund, who have helped us show us a better path.
Well, speaking of showing a better path, I mean, I was also really thrilled that Greta Thunberg has been named the Person of the Year Time Magazine. I think she might be the youngest one besides being... That was great. But what was even better was her response to it is, you need to put the focus on all the, you know, hundreds of thousands of millions of young people who are fighting in their own communities and doing doing more important work than me. And every time I watch her deflect the kind of attention she's getting and reflect it back onto all the people that are working alongside and beyond what she does, it makes me think she's an amazing leader, because I just don't feel... I don't feel any ego in what she's doing,
yes,
and any sense of like power grabbing. I feel like she's this interesting kind of little beacon that's there to teach all of us a lesson of the next level we need to go to really fight this.
And I remind people that there's an opportunity to support those young people every Friday at City Hall.
Right.
We have a dear friend, Violet, who is on climate strike from school every Friday, and that's an easy way to show our support.
And they're calling it, now it's Fire Drill Friday is what they're calling it. And what time does that start?
I believe they're out there from around 10:30 to 2 or so every Friday. Different amounts of school children from the Portland area, yeah, and they're welcoming adults to join them.
Yeah, well, I know in Washington, D.C., Jane Fonda has been getting arrested every week and plans to spend her 82nd birthday in jail.
I got to march with her when we were out there for the award. That was really a fun experience.
Yeah, so on both ends, there's Greta on one end and there's Jane Fonda on the other end. And I think Jane Fonda is learning a lot from Greta, actually. I mean, she mentions her a lot. Mm. But I think it's been very interesting to watch the transformation of Jane Fonda from somebody who I felt was a little bit of an airhead. She had the right sentiments, but not a lot of depth of thought about how she was dealing with things back in the Vietnam War days. And I feel that she has learned so much and that she has gained this amazing wisdom as an older woman that she's actually deserves the appellation of elder. And yet I love the way she's connecting with very young people.
Well, and really using her privilege and kind of challenging the rest of us, right, to use our privilege to step up and do more, because the climate catastrophe is upon us and we can't just keep doing business as usual. So I appreciate that about kind of using her story, using her celebrity, using her privilege in ways that are really challenging to the rest of us, and bringing other celebrities out there with her and, you know, really pushing it to a new level.
Actually, I was hearing an interview. It was a wonderful interview a few weeks ago that Robin Morgan did on the show Wings with Jane Fonda. And I didn't know who was speaking at first, and both voices sounded familiar. And so the woman who was being interviewed sounded a little bit like Elizabeth Warren. And I thought, but she sounds much more radical than Elizabeth Warren. If Elizabeth Warren is saying all these things, boy, she's incredible. And then, oh no, it's Jane Fonda. But then that equally amazed me, because I felt like she is saying exactly the same things that people that I have on the show a lot who are saying, who are in much less privileged positions and maybe feeling like they're really more on the front lines as well. So I just was really impressed to see how much she's been able to digest, and then she puts it out in such a cogent way, and yet a way that's very accessible. So moving on, I want to get a little bit more about the fossil fuel fight and then get onto the nuclear stuff. So while we're on the fossil fuel fight, and Regna made mention of this incredible action that happened at the state capitol in Salem, I guess it's almost a month ago now, or 3 weeks ago, whatever, on November 21st, and which was almost 1,000 people gathering on the steps, and just it was a powerful rally. And someday, if I have time to edit the audio, I'll play it on the show, because it was really
Go Barbara.
It was really great. And actually, I wasn't surprised, because I had an inside voice. I knew something was going to happen. I wasn't sure what, but I knew there was going to be something. And sure enough, that something turned out that while the almost 1,000 of us were singing We've Got the Power inside the rotunda with this amazing reverb of the rotunda, and it was very powerful. There were 85 people who were going upstairs to Kate Brown's office and sat in for about 8 hours.
And the first people that went into the office were these 10 Southern Oregonians that are directly impacted by the project. They were the ones that started it.
Right, and it was their idea, I have the feeling, too. The people that went in was Kelly Campbell. So I want to just kind of get your experience. If you could describe what it was like to be inside the office, what happened, and what happened at the end.
Well, it was really an amazing experience. As you said, the rally itself was incredible, and the artwork was so beautiful. And as Ed Edmo was speaking, an eagle flew over the Capitol building.
Actually,
and
over
out
our
and
heads,
over
really close.
The heads of the people in the rally. And I mean, you just couldn't have engineered it any better.
And then Ed said, he said, I've never been upstaged by an eagle before.
Yes.
And then he read this poem about eagles. And I think he was planning on reading it before. So it was one of these magic moments.
It really felt like a powerful, powerful moment to be there. And as you mentioned, people coming into the rotunda. And then following the lead of Southern Oregonians directly impacted, many of us came and sat in all day in Kate Brown's office. And 21 of us stayed and were arrested later in the evening and spent the night in Marion County Jail. And our message really was, we need Kate Brown, who is, you know, wants to be a climate leader, talks about climate all the time. We need her to come out and oppose Jordan Cove and the Pacific Connector Pipeline. If it's built, it'll be the biggest greenhouse gas emitter in the entire state. There's just no way you can be a leader on climate and not take a position against this project. And so that was our message to her there that day. We had a wonderful teach-in all day long, led by Indigenous people, heard from Southern Oregonians, including a woman named Sandy, who went to jail with me, who was a Southern Oregonian rancher, who has worked for decades to bring the salmon back to the streams on her property and has succeeded. And if this pipeline goes through, the pipeline will go straight through those creeks and destroy everything she's been doing. So, I mean, these are the kind of people in this fight. These are the leaders in this fight that, you know, this means everything to them. And it was so powerful to be in the room with folks like that. We did speak with Governor Brown by phone, and then she came in later that evening and listened and spoke to us for about 10 minutes, but unfortunately we didn't get any commitment out of her that day. I do hope that listening to some of the stories of her constituents and listening to the passion and understanding, as she does understand, that climate change is upon us, that it is a catastrophe, I'm hopeful that this will be one of the things that helps her get herself on the record on the right side of history.
We hope that. I watched the video. There's some really strong video. It was basically a Facebook live feed that somebody was filming until I actually at the end of it, or there's another video I saw where this person is talking to the Oregon State Police as they're escorting her down the stairs out of the Capitol, and she kept asking them to let go of her. And then she said, I'm leaving. So I thought that was the end of the video. So nobody videoed the arrest as far as I could tell. But there was this pretty powerful video of when Kate comes into the office and people start asking her questions, and the way that she took control of it was a little bit unnerving to watch. And at one moment, for a few moments, as I was watching her in her body language in a stance, she reminded me, she looked just like that puppet that had been outside of the Kate Brown puppet, which has been appearing for several years in front of the, well, as long as she's been governor, in front of the state capitol at Jordan Cove demonstrations. And so what I was sensing was a great deal of discomfort on her part. I appreciated that she came in. I think that that took a lot of nerve on her part or whatever to really, at least it took it what was going on seriously enough, but I could see that she was really trying to be in control and trying to manage the questions. And at one point when I think it was Bill Bradbury, who also got arrested, right?
He did not get arrested, but he was there all day. Bill Bradbury, our former Secretary of State, was amazing.
Yeah,
yes.
Well, he's a great guy. And I mean, he's been at a lot of events I've been at down in Coos Bay, and because he lives in Bandon now.
Yeah.
And he's just really amazing. But it was interesting to watch the former Secretary of State looking at another former Secretary of State and, you know, looking at and sort of like his hidden agenda could be, Kate, after I was Secretary of State, I went and studied with Al Gore and became a climate leader. And, you know, really, and that's what he's been doing for the last, whatever, 12 years or so. But he talked about how divided the community was. And then Kate came back and used that as against why she could make any decision, because the state is divided. And I was hoping that somebody was going to shout out the statistics that the poll that the landowners and other probably power pass frack gas paid for, which showed that I'm not sure what the percentage is, but an overwhelming majority of Oregonians are opposed to Jordan Cove now.
I think that has been a huge change, and I'm sure that Representative DeFazio was looking at that poll when he was encouraged to come out against the project. And the fact that he does do so, he opposes it now, gives her a little more room politically to move as well. So we're hoping for that.
Worth also noting that Kate Brown's in her last term as governor. She's term limited out now. And earlier this year, Governor Jay Inslee in Washington flipped his position on climamethanol and came out against both climamethanol and the Tacoma LNG facility, saying that, you know, he could not in good conscience, you know, continue to, you know, stand idly by when these projects were, you know, the science is so clear that this kind of project is rapidly accelerating the climate crisis, these massive gas projects. Now, he needs to do more in Washington to actually stop those projects. But that's why there's such a clear precedent. You know, it is so possible for governors like Kate Brown to take a stand. And so it's really time for her to do it.
Absolutely. And Governor Cuomo's taken a similar stand in New York. Senator
Stronger, actually. Yes. I mean, he's actually done something. Like, mm-hmm. I think there's a moratorium which is turning into a ban on fracking.
I think so. Yeah. So it's possible to do. Senator Merkley's come out against this.
Actually, absolutely.
And we need her leadership on this. There's no other way.
Well, this documentary that I just did recently, Holding the Thin Green Line, which the second hour is all about Jordan Cove, and as I was playing it for some friends before it aired, and everybody was pointing out this is a call to Kate Brown. I mean, I don't know. There must be at least 10 minutes of that piece, which is people shouting out to Kate Brown, "Do something. You need to. If you want to be a climate hero, you better take action on this." And I keep thinking, how can she not hear all these voices? And she certainly heard the voices at the demonstration on November 21st and in the sit-in. I don't understand how she can, in good conscience, not listen and not really start to shift her opinion. But mm-hmm. It's like watching a three-dimensional chess game, watching all the political maneuvers. And DeFazio's turnaround on Jordan Cove seemed to be kind of coincidentally timed with the fact that he's got this very strong opponent in the primary, Doyle Canning, who's running in the primary against DeFazio for the 4th District here in Oregon. And she's a little bit more formidable than I think anybody. I don't think he's ever had a serious contender before, but she's actually getting some traction. And I know I was at a house party for her on Sunday, and it seems like there's a lot of sense that DeFazio was paying close attention to that.
Yeah, and also, you know, years and years and years of DeFazio's constituents calling him, emailing him, you know, lobbying him on this all the time. You know, I think it was a real groundswell of combination of those things. And, you know, it also came, you know, a couple weeks after this massive action in Salem, you know, so I think all of these factors together came together on that. And I think it's time for Kate Brown to come out next.
I'm just kind of curious, before we go on to the next subject, which will be nuclear disarmament and weapons and all the other stuff, is just what can be done? I mean, what are you all thinking about doing to push Kate and whoever else needs to be pushed? I mean, the Department of State Lands decision is supposed to happen in January, I believe. And they've been pushing that down the road for 9 months now. But what are you seeing as a strategy to make the next step?
Well, something that every single Portlander who's listening to this, every single Oregonian who's listening to this can do right now is get onto Kate Brown's website, give her a phone call, and tell her that she must oppose this facility, that it is, you know, unacceptable for her to remain neutral on this, and that if she wants to really truly be the leader on climate that she claims to be, she can't be neutral on a moving train, right? You know, or pipeline, right? So that's something that everyone can take action on right away. And then, you know, keep continuing to stay tuned, look for the opportunities to engage when they come. You know, there's an amazing coalition of different folks working on this with the support of the Power Pass Frack Gas Coalition, and there's going to be lots more opportunities to share your voice.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Damon Mott-Story with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Kelly Campbell, who's the executive director, and Regna Merritt, who recently retired and who is now on the advisory board. You raised your hand, Regna?
I did. What Damon said is true. We need to continue to push hard now. But I think over the long term, there's a bigger issue. And I hope it's not a long-term problem. But, you know, Kate has strong support from labor and the construction industry, the construction trades, et cetera. And we've seen that dynamic played out over and over again with multiple export terminal fights. And it was wonderful to see the longshoremen join or partner with the Stand Up to Oil Coalition.
And actually were the leaders. They were the first ones to come out against the Tesoro Savage.
For the Tesoro Savage oil export proposal on the Columbia River. But I think until we have like a government, state, and federal that supports a Green New Deal, where we have an opportunity to work with labor on projects that advance all of our interests together at the same time in a massive change in, you know, infrastructure support, clean energy, and a just transition, that we're going to see these kinds of difficulties played out over again, not just in Oregon, not just on the West Coast, or, you know, where... But, you know, I look forward to having those conversations, and I think it's really important. I think a lot of your listeners, our listeners, are engaged in elections right now, but this is the season, this is the time to figure out how you can best move the needle here so that we have a chance of coming together at some point in the not-so-distant future with labor to create a society that is based on, you know, fierce love, justice and equality, and, you know, provide a livable planet for our children.
It sounds like a topic for a good show in the near future. So maybe we'll talk about that and get me in touch with the right people. I just want to have this image before we move on to nuclear power and nuclear weapons. But I'm working on this video that goes along with my documentary, and we found these maps that showed all the pipelines in the United States. And when you look at that map or any of those maps, you understand what Eric DePlace means by the thin green line, because there are these networks of pipelines that go all over the United States. And in some areas, like around the Gulf Coast, and particularly Texas, the whole area is black. You get to the Northwest, there's like three little black lines, and it's almost all clean. Of course, if the Pacific Connector pipeline went in, that would be one very dark line, and there's all these other proposed pipelines. If the Williams pipeline were doubled so that they could build the methanol refinery, that would double that little line into a much
and
darker
Klamath,
line.
Yes.
And Klamath, yeah, and Klamath. So it really gave me a sense of what we're fighting for, looking at this map where this white space where other states, and it's almost every state except Washington and Oregon, is just covered with black pipeline routes. So that's what we're fighting for. And I guess I'm very glad you guys are doing what you're doing, because I think so far we're keeping our state clear of all those pipeline black lines on the map.
Well, and hopefully a future where we can, you know, clear it up all over the country and all over the world, right? You know, that's the hope.
So I want to move.
I just read that there was a permit granted for LNG to arrive by train to the Delaware River. I think it might be the first such project in the lower 48 states. So we still have rail. We need to worry about that, even though we don't have as many pipelines.
That's one of the, it's a big concern. I follow this Facebook forum, Redefine Tacoma Community Forum, and there was a posting on it last week about that decision. And that really frightens the folks in Tacoma, because the Port of Tacoma is really still basically based on fossil fuel infrastructure expansion. And it's a great possibility that they could start trucking in LNG to the Port of Tacoma by train, because they have this incredible train network. Kind of reminds me
right.
of Auschwitz.
Right, and, you know, when I say we still have rail, of course we love the public purposes for rail.
Right.
But, you know, the safety of the passengers and the environment are at risk with all of the traffic and fossil fuels on those lines.
Well, the issue with rail, too, I mean, it's interesting when Warren Buffett started, when he bought Burlington Northern Santa Fe, and he bought it because he saw it as a great means to transport oil and gas. And I'm not sure about gas, but definitely oil. And that's when I realized how evil he was, because it really, I think, changed the function of rail trains when oil trains started. And the coal trains were moving in that direction, but basically coal trains, as far as I know, were basically in coal country. It wasn't like they were crossing grass swaths of North America to carry coal from point A to point B. But the oil trains have like taken it to a whole new level. So I guess that's why, and we'll be talking a lot about that in coming months, particularly about global partners and, of course, Zenith. Though we did stop a pipeline, right, with Zenith? Is that true?
A small one in Portland,
yeah,
yes.
About, what, mm-hmm. It was about 10 feet long. Mm-hmm. But it was like, what, a couple blocks long or something?
Mm-hmm. Under a street, yeah.
Yeah, but it really, I think, is going to slow down the kind of development they want. And, mm-hmm. and I think mm-hmm. the other thing that's really important is that when the city stopped the pipeline that Zenith was claiming was just going to be for biofuel, that we're also calling out the lies and knowing that the fossil fuel mm-hmm. industry does not tell the truth. So speaking of strange things, Kelly, I wanted to end on a note. I know a struggle you're working on now that Damon told me about, which is that I guess Oregon State University is like one of the incubators for these modular micro nuclear reactors. So let's talk a little bit about that and why you're so concerned about that.
Sure. So those are the small modular reactors. They create the same waste. They have the same problems that other reactors do, but they're new and shiny and bright, and they've never been built before. And so there's more, you know, interest in investing in something like this. They can't actually be built in Oregon because we have the moratorium here. But the idea is this NuScale company that was incubated at Oregon State University, that's an Oregon-based company, would like to build them perhaps in Idaho or maybe even in Washington on the Hanford Reservation. So we have a report that Damon can talk a little bit more about mm-hmm, that's mm-hmm. coming out on this.
Yeah, we're working with a physicist based out of British Columbia who is going to be able to sort of help to elucidate why it is that this particular, you know, sort of gleaming, shiny new sort of concept for a different kind of nuclear reactor is snake oil, basically. It's not going to be any different than the issues that we see with existing nuclear reactors. And, you know, there's all these big claims that it's going to be really inexpensive and very, you know, safe and no accidents could possibly ever happen. But, you know, that's what they said about Chernobyl, too, is that what happened there could not have possibly happened.
Oh, and Fukushima. Then it did.
Right. And then at Fukushima. Right. And we're already seeing massive amounts of money coming in from the U.S. Department of Energy to try to subsidize this technology because it doesn't pencil out on its own. They're trying to make Utah small utilities foot the bill for a project in Idaho for a company that's based out of Oregon. So they're trying to defer as much possible and disperse any opposition to them and try to, you know, sneak into all of these conversations about clean energy and transitioning off of fossil fuels. And I think it's so important that we not cause harm in our transition away from fossil fuels, right, by investing in this, you know, absolutely impractically expensive technology that is doing so much harm to different communities near uranium and uranium mines and nuclear waste storage areas.
Well, back during the 2008 elections, the only presidential candidate in the Democratic side who took a stand against nuclear power when they were all talking about renewable energies and, you know, and concern about climate change, the one was John Edwards. Even Obama saw that nuclear power was seen as a green energy. So how do we counter that?
Well, I don't know. What I keep coming back to with all of this and the learning that I've been doing is really around this as a justice issue as well, that we're starting with mining uranium on indigenous land. Almost all uranium worldwide is mined on indigenous land, and it's indigenous people whose health is harmed by it. So you don't ever get from that starting point to a clean energy source.
And uranium mining is probably as bad, if not worse, than coal mining. I mean, people get cancer from uranium mining.
Yes, it's horrible. So I think to me that's, you know, that's where these things all connect, is that you don't get to justice from starting in that place. And you don't get to justice when you end up with waste that is, you know, typically stored near frontline communities. So there's just no way that nuclear can be part of that solution in a way that fits a just transition model.
And it's all very connected to our nuclear weapons crisis too, right? And in all of these sort of like very panicked conversations in Congress about where are we going to put all of this waste that we amassed from all of the Cold War nuclear weapons manufacturing and all of this, you know, proposed nuclear weapons modernization that people are foolishly trying to push. Right. There is not really a permanent geological repository that works for this yet. And Yucca Mountain is one that is fiercely opposed by the Shoshone tribe in Nevada. And
so is Harry Reid.
Right. And, you know, the, what we're seeing is in both of these cases here, this is just this enormous, you know, unmitigated problem that we just cannot make any worse before we make it better. That's, you know, that's another moment where the health angle really lends a nice framework, right? You know, you don't make the problem worse, right? That's step one. And then you work towards solutions.
So for final words to our listeners, what are you seeing that you're going to be taking into the next year in terms of the work that PSR is doing on the forefront of creating just transition and addressing the injustices both of nuclear development and fossil fuels?
Well, I'd say in terms of the nuclear weapons work and the connections to these other issues is pursuing that justice angle and really working with other cities in Oregon who are interested in supporting the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons by passing resolutions in their municipalities following what Portland did and what the state did. I do want to mention that the Arms Control Association has just nominated the Oregon legislators who were our chief sponsors of the nuclear weapons for their arms control persons of the year. And you can go to the Arms Control Association website and vote for Michael Dembrough and Tana Sanchez and Alyssa Kenny Geyer. So I think it's another exciting example of sort of how our local work here is pushing movements nationally to kind of step up and look at things from a different angle.
Yeah. And 2020 is going to be the year when we see the first grants go out from the Portland Clean Energy Fund. So we're going to get to watch what kinds of, you know, early steps happen on those projects that really are going to help bring community benefits to the Portlanders that deserve it most. So I'm really excited to look into that. You know, we're also going to be seeing, you know, the deadlines in February for numerous permit decisions on the Jordan Cove LNG project. And that's going to be a really, you know, we're not expecting that to be a happy time, right, when the FERC is concerned from the federal agency. And so it's really going to be time to step up these fights for a livable future.
If I can add one more thing on the nuclear side of things, next year is the 75th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so we're already talking with partners about a number of events and actions throughout the year to mark that and to call for Never Again.
Great. Well, it's been great talking with you guys. I want to thank Regna Merritt, Kelly Campbell, and Damon Mastori. And I hope to have you on again soon. This has really been fun.
I want to thank you, Barbara, because you've brought the voice of individuals, organizations, and the movement to radio and your documentary. And you help move the needle, too.
Well, thank you.
Here, here.
We're trying. Well, we've been talking today with Kelly Campbell, Regna Merritt, and Damon Mastori with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll be talking with Claudia Riedner, who's with Redefine Tacoma, about the latest developments in the struggle to stop the Tacoma LNG facility. My engineer is the noted Dr. Patsy Kohlberg with PSR. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by The Impressions. Thanks for listening.
People mind.